or two. That gave me enough time to grab some lunch. I drove south, back past the Severson's house, still surrounded with official vehicles. I pulled into the driveway of the Kennewick Inn. I heard it was where Ted and Miranda stayed when they were in Maine. A wooden sign that advertised vacancies swung in the breeze off the ocean. I thought to myself that when the national press got hold of this story, their vacancy issue was going to be solved. There was a smaller hanging sign at the front of the inn's main building that advertised the Livery Pub. I walked toward it along the narrow sidewalk, crunching through desiccated leaves, and went down an exterior stone stairwell to the basement entrance. Inside, the livery was a long, narrow space that smelled of wood smoke and French fries. I took a seat at the bar. There were only a few people in the pub, but all of them were talking feverishly, no doubt spreading rumors about what had happened a mile up the road. I ordered a cup of coffee and a cheeseburger from the rotund bartender. While I waited, I pulled out my notebook and looked at what I had written earlier that morning. Polly Grenier. Why would she lie for Brad? I now knew that she hadn't lied, that she'd merely been used by Brad as an unwitting alibi. Why did Ted have a key for Brad's house? I still didn't know, but I had learned from Polly that Brad and Ted had spent some social time together at Cooley's. Whose idea had that been? Could Brad have given Ted the key for some reason? The final note I'd written was, why did Lily Kintner lie to me? I still wondered about that, even though I didn't think she had anything to do with what had happened between Brad and the Seversons. Still, I pulled out my phone, checked to see that I had service, and pulled up the one image of Lily Kintner that I knew was online. A low-res photograph of her and her father from about 10 years earlier, but Lily hadn't changed much since then. Same red hair and the same style, same pale skin and intense eyes. When the bartender delivered my cheeseburger, I turned the phone around on a whim and asked if he recognized the girl in the picture. He bent close, studied the phone screen for about 5 seconds. I was so prepared for him to say no that I barely registered it when he said, "Sure, she was here earlier this week. Stayed a couple of nights. Pretty lady." "Why was she here?" I asked, trying to keep the surprise and the excitement out of my voice. "Couldn't tell you. Drank Sam Light, I think. Always remember a drink order." He moved away to greet a pair of customers that had just taken seats at the other end of the bar. I looked at Lily's picture on my phone, a few grainy dots that formed her face. Was it possible she had more to do with all this than I thought? I knew I would need to see her again, find out why she was lying to me, find out why she'd come to Maine after Ted had been killed. I didn't expect to find out much, but it meant that I'd get to see her again. Sooner rather than later. I took a bite of my cheeseburger, which was far better than a cheeseburger had any right to be. Life was looking up.
Chapter 30. Lily. My father fidgeted and sighed on the entire drive from JFK out to Shepog. "It's just Mom," I said. "She's as full of shit as she ever was." He smiled at me, but there was still watery fear in his eyes. "Give it a shot," I continued. "If it doesn't work, then we'll figure something else out." "I could always come and live with you, Lil," he said. That was the inevitability I was hoping to avoid, of course, but I simply placed my hand on his knee and squeezed. As we rolled over the low hills of Connecticut into familiar terrain, my father got quiet, looking out the window. The leaves on the trees were past their initial burst of radiant color. The reds had turned to rust. The yellows faded. Pulling into the driveway of Monk's, my father said, "I can feel my balls going into hiding. Now I know I'm coming home." As we removed my father's two unwieldy suitcases from the trunk of the car, my mother came to the door, aproned and paint-splattered. She had applied 2 slashes of bright red lipstick to her mouth. "The patriarch returns," she said, and it sounded rehearsed. It made me realize she was a little nervous herself. "Sharon," my father said, pushing his glasses up onto his forehead so he could see her at a distance. "You look the same." It was probably the nicest thing he could have said to her under the circumstances. She nodded and went back into the house. After helping my father unpack his things and get set up in the first-floor guest room toward the rear of the house, we took a quick walk around the property before the sun disappeared completely.
"It gets dark early here," my father said. "I remember that."
"Only in the fall and winter," I said. "Not all year round."
"I suppose I could do some raking tomorrow."
"Mom would like that. She hates to rake."
"I remember that. She always had me do all the raking."
"Well, you or that boy across the street."
"Right."
My father tightened the scarf around his neck, even though it was warm for a late October evening.
"Remember when you were little you used to crawl into the pile of leaves?"
"I don't know," I said.
"Other kids always wanted to jump on leaves, apparently, but you used to burrow into them. Stay inside them for hours."
"You don't remember that?"
"Kind of." "You were such a strange little girl. Before you got your nose into books, we used to think we'd given birth to a wild animal. You barely smiled. You'd creep around outside for hours. You made animal sounds. We used to call you our fox girl and say that you were being raised by humans. Hope we didn't cock you up too bad."
"You did okay," I said, as a little bit of rain began to fall out of the sky. "You're letting me get my parents back together, the dream of every child of divorce."
"That wasn't your dream, was it?"
my father said as we turned and headed back to the house. Dark, except for the light coming from the kitchen.
"God, no. I was only joking. Besides, you're not getting back together, I hope. Just living together.
Mutual parasitism.
Isn't that the plan?"
"Yes, that's the plan.
Peace and quiet. Maybe write one more book. Maybe not. I just want to live out the rest of my life and not hurt anybody. That's all I'm really hoping for."
Dinner went well. My mother roasted a chicken, and my father didn't say anything bad about it, even though it was overcooked. We drank a single bottle of wine among the three of us, and afterward my father offered to clean up, saying he'd clean up after every meal.
"I can't cook, Sharon, you know that, but I'm happy to clean."
She rolled her eyes, but just at me. My father was already clearing the table, making careful stacks by the sink. We went to the living room. There was a television in there now, something we'd never had when I was a child. I mentioned it.
"For PBS," my mother said, as we sat on opposite sides of the worn-out couch.
I thought we'd talk about my father, but my mother told me in exhaustive detail about a glowing review of some artist she used to know.
I never thought much of him, but I guess I was wrong all along, at least according to the New York Times.
I listened to her, and I thought that this crazy arrangement between my mother and father just might work, at least for a little while. Over their years of separation, they had come to mean less and less to each other, and that might allow them to live together. They didn't love each other enough to hurt each other. I had left the following day after breakfast. I was in no rush and turned north at Hartford to drive up through the Pioneer Valley, eventually connecting with Route 2 and driving back to Winslow along more scenic routes. It really was my favorite time of year, the blustery air filled with dead leaves, the houses decorated for Halloween. 1 week ago, I had learned of Ted Severson's death. And now, that whole sordid chapter of my life was closed. Miranda and Brad were gone as well, and I had gotten away with it. Any anxiety I had about being caught was gone. Now I just felt relaxed and full of power. I had even enjoyed spending time in my parents' company. The murders had become a big story. From what I gathered, Kennewick had been flooded with reporters, all trying to untangle the story of the glamorous young couple murdered within 1 week of each other. Brad Daggett had not been found, and he never would be. If they'd located the truck, that hadn't made the news. He had killed both Ted and Miranda, and forensic evidence would prove it. And he would never be found to tell his story. I thought about what my father had said to me the day before, how he wanted to get through the rest of his life without hurting anybody else. Maybe I could turn that into my goal as well. It was how I had felt after killing Chet, and how I had felt after killing Eric in London. It was how I felt now. I didn't regret what I'd done in the past. Miranda and Eric had both hurt me. Chet had wanted to, and Brad, while he hadn't hurt me directly, had murdered an innocent man. It had probably been a mistake to invite Ted Severson into my life. I'd taken enormous risks in the past few weeks, and was lucky to have gotten away with them. But now, I was done. It was over. I would live a quiet life and make sure that no one could hurt me again. I would continue to survive, knowing, as I'd known that night in the meadow, the stars pouring their light down on me, that I was special, that I was born with a different kind of morality, the morality of an animal, of a crow or a fox or an owl, and not of a normal human being. I got off Route 2 and drove through Winslow Center toward my house. There was an Oktoberfest happening on the town green, a polka band playing, and a beer tent set up. I rolled down my window. The air smelled of apple cider. I considered stopping, but decided I'd rather get home. I drove the 2 miles toward my house. As I approached my house, I could see a long, white car in my driveway. Easy to spot through the now leafless trees. A jolt of fear went through me, and I almost drove past, but I turned into the driveway, telling myself that all would be fine. Leaning up against the car was the detective who had come to ask me questions earlier in the week, Henry Kimball from the Boston Police Department. When he saw me, he dropped the cigarette he was smoking and put it out under his shoe. I parked and got out of the car. He came toward me, an unreadable smile on his face.
Chapter 31. Kimball. After lunch on Sunday, I drove out to Winslow again to talk with Lily Kintner. She wasn't home, but it was a crisp fall day. Not too cold, and I decided to wait. I figured she was probably out to brunch and would be back soon. I leaned up against my car so that I had a view of the pond beyond her cottage, and I carefully rolled a cigarette, one of my allotted two of the day. Brad Daggett had not been found. The only solid lead was that a garage in Kennewick had reported that one of the cars it was working on had had its license plate swapped. Mike Como, the mechanic, noticed only because the new plate was so much cleaner than the rest of the vehicle. It turned out to be the plate from Daggett's truck. So Brad Daggett had been smart enough to switch plates before taking off from Maine. An APB was issued for the new plate number, but there hadn't been any hits yet. I was starting to doubt that there would be. I lit my cigarette, tilted my head back, and let the sun hit my face. Overhead, a flock of geese toiled by. Just as I was finishing my cigarette, Lily turned her Honda Accord into the driveway. I tried to read her face through the windshield, but she seemed to be looking at me with nothing more than mild curiosity. After she parked and got out of the car, I walked up to her, reintroduced myself. "I remember you," she said. "It was only a few days ago." She had an overnight bag with her, dark blue with gray polka dots, and I asked her if she'd been away. "Down with my parents in Connecticut. My father just came back from London." "Oh, to live here?" "That's the plan right now." "What can I do for you, Detective? I heard about Miranda. It's shocking." "I have a few more questions. I was hoping we could sit and talk again. That's fine. Just give me a moment to get settled. We could sit on the back deck if you like. It's not that cold. I followed her into her cottage, through the living room, and out through a door in her kitchen to a small back deck that was plastered with leaves. Let me get you a rag and you can wipe off the chairs, she said. I did as I was told, clearing two of the wooden deck chairs of the bright yellow fan-shaped leaves from a ginkgo tree. I took a seat, and after about 5 minutes, Lily returned. She was still wearing jeans, but she'd taken her coat off and was now wearing a white V-neck sweater that looked like cashmere. Her hair was down, and her face looked freshly washed and free of makeup. What can I do for you? I decided earlier that I would come straight to the point, so I said, I want to know why you lied to me. She didn't look surprised, but she slowly blinked her pale eyelids. About what, exactly? Your relationship to Ted Severson, and the fact that you went up to Kennewick on Sunday and Monday night of this week. You didn't think you should have mentioned that to me last time I was here? I can explain, she said, and I apologize for lying. I'd been stressed out by this situation with my father. When you showed up the first time, I was terrified of getting mixed up in a murder investigation. It would have been too much for him. That's the reason I pretended not to know Ted. I hope you know I wouldn't have lied if I thought our relationship had anything to do with the murder. What exactly was your relationship? We met in London at the airport. I didn't even recognize him at first, but we got to talking, and we eventually figured out that we had met before, through Miranda. We were both in business class, and we wound up sitting next to each other, and he told me that he thought his wife was cheating on him with his house builder. It's kind of important information, I said. We would have appreciated knowing that a week ago.
I know, I'm sorry. It's not like he knew for sure. He just thought it was probably the case. I knew Miranda in college, and I thought he was probably right. Anyway, we hit it off. He opened up to me, the way it sometimes happens on airplanes.
So you became involved?
No, not really. Not romantically. We met again once at a bar in Concord for a drink, but we didn't pursue anything. He was married.
But you liked him.
She slowly blinked again. I did. He was a nice man.
When did you hear that he'd been killed?
I read about it in the Globe on Sunday. The article made it sound as though he'd been killed by a burglar. But I wondered.
Wondered whether he'd been killed by Brad Daggett?
That's the name of the contractor, right? And you think he killed both Ted and then Miranda?
Just tell me why you decided to go up to Maine.
I don't know exactly. Lots of reasons. Ted had told me how much he loved it up there, so I decided to drive up. I guess to mourn him. We'd only met twice, but both meetings were pretty intense. And I suppose I also went up there to see if I could find anything out. I guess I was pretending I was Nancy Drew. It's stupid, I know.
What did you do while you were up there?
Took walks, ate dinner at the bar at the hotel. Everyone was talking about the murder, and I listened in, but I didn't hear anything about Miranda having an affair. I thought I would. I thought everyone would talk about it. According to Ted, Miranda practically lived at the Kennewick Inn. If he was sleeping with someone local, you'd figure that everyone would know about it. That's what I thought, anyway. But no one said a thing. I even went to Cooley's. It's the bar down the street, the more local one, and had a drink there, thinking I might hear something, or even see Brad. But I didn't.
What exactly were you going to do if you found out Brad and Miranda were having an affair?
Trap him, obviously, she said. Get a confession out of him. Make a citizen's arrest. Her face hadn't changed, and it took me a moment to realize she was joking. I smirked, and she smiled back. There was a crease between her upper lip and her nose when she smiled. Honestly, she continued, I don't know what I was going to do. I didn't have a plan. And just because Brad and Miranda were having an affair doesn't mean that had anything to do with his death.
We're pretty sure that Brad Daggett killed both of the Seversons.
And he's missing?
Yes. We were quiet a moment. I watched Lily touch the arms of her left hand in succession against the armrest of the chair. It was the first outward sign of nervousness I'd seen from her.
Finally, she said, I screwed up. I should have told you everything the first time you came here. I should have told you that Ted thought his wife was having an affair with Brad. I'm sorry. Honestly, when you came, I assumed that Ted had been killed by a burglar. I was almost embarrassed that I went up to Maine to try and do my own investigation. It sounded stupid. Like Nancy Drew, I said. Are you calling my childhood hero stupid? No, of course not. I loved Nancy Drew, too. Why do you think I became a detective? A ragged-looking cat came up onto the deck, mewling at Lily. You have a cat, I said. Not really, she answered, standing up. His name is Mog, but he mostly lives outside. He comes here when he's hungry. I'm going to get him some food. Can I get you anything from inside? No, thanks, I said. While she was gone, I clucked at Mog, but he stayed where he was. His eyes were different colors, or else one of his eyes was damaged somehow. Lily returned with cat food in a bowl and set it down on the edge of the deck. Mog squatted and began to eat. I wanted to stay, but I had nothing left to ask. I still didn't believe that Lily was telling me the whole truth, but her answers were reasonable enough. Your father, I said. How's he doing? Oh, he's about the same. I think getting him out of England is the best thing for him. He took a beating from the press. Is he still writing? He told me he thinks he might have one more book in him, but I don't know about that. We'll see. Maybe he'll get inspired now that he's back living with my mother. I thought your parents were divorced. They are, thank God. This is just an arrangement. Strange, I know, but my mother needs money and my father's going to help out now that he's staying in her house. Plus, my father can't be alone. It's a shot in the dark, but if it works, it will solve both their problems. If it doesn't, my father could come here and live with me. I wanted to ask her more about her father, partly because I was interested in him, but mostly because I wanted to stay out here on Lily Kintner's back deck. I wanted to keep looking at her. The sun was behind her, turning her hair into a fiery red. She had crossed her arms across her middle, tightening her sweater against her body, and I could see the high swell of her breasts and the faint outline of a pink bra beneath the thin white cashmere. I thought of ways to prolong my stay. I could ask more questions about her father, about her love of Nancy Drew, about her job at Winslow, but I knew that I shouldn't. This hadn't been a social call. I stood up, and Lily also stood. Mog finished eating and came and rubbed his side against Lily's ankle, then bounded off the way he had come. Oh, one more thing, I said, remembering a last question that I'd meant to ask. You said the first time we met that Miranda and you knew each other in college.
Uh-huh, at Mather College in Newchester, Connecticut.
Miranda told me you stole her boyfriend.
She did she? Well, we dated the same guy. Miranda dated him first, then I did, then he went back to her. It was a mess at the time, but it was years ago.
So when you met Ted and realized he was married to Miranda, and that he was unhappy, you didn't think it was your opportunity for revenge?
Sure, it crossed my mind. I liked Ted, and I didn't like Miranda. But no, that's not what was between Ted and me. We weren't romantic. I was just someone for him to talk to.
Lily walked me back through her house and out to my car. She held out her hand and I shook it, her palm dry and warm. When we let go, Lily's fingertips gently ran along my hand, and I wondered if it was intentional, or if I was imagining something between us that wasn't there. Her face told me nothing. Before getting into my car, I turned and asked her,
What was the name of the boyfriend?
Excuse me, she said.
The boyfriend in college that both you and Miranda went out with.
Oh, him, she said, and a slight flush of color crossed her cheeks. She hesitated, then said, It was Eric Washburn, but he's, dead now.
Oh, I said. How did that happen?
It was right after college. He died from anaphylactic shock. He had a nut allergy.
Oh, I said again, not knowing what else to say. I'm sorry.
Don't be, she said. It was a long time ago. I drove away. As I headed back to Boston, a ledge of low clouds began to blank the sun. It was early afternoon, but felt like dusk. I was going over the conversation with Lily. I believed a lot of what she had said to me, but still felt lied to. I knew that she had left some things out, just as she had the first time we talked. But why? And why had Lily hesitated at the end when I asked her the name of her college boyfriend? It felt as though she didn't want to tell me. She told me it had been a long time ago, but it wasn't really. She was only in her late 20s. Eric Washburn. I said the name out loud to myself to make sure I remembered it.
Chapter 32. Lily. 1 week after I'd been interviewed for a second time by Detective Kimball, I drove back to Concord Center. I'd been following the progress on the Severson murder case every night on the local news, even though there were never any developments. I knew there wouldn't be. Brad Daggett was not going to be found. It felt good knowing that I was the only human being in the world who knew where Brad was, who knew that he was never going to be found drinking a daiquiri on some beach in the Caribbean. He was slowly rotting in a forgotten meadow. I knew it, and so did the birds and animals that passed his way. They'd smell him and think that some large animal had died, and then they'd go about their day. It was the first Sunday since daylight savings time had ended. The morning had started cold, snow squalls moving through at dawn, but the snow had cleared by noon, the sky now a low, threatening shelf of chalky clouds. I took back roads from Winslow to Concord, driving slowly, listening to classical music on one of the public radio stations. It was mid-afternoon by the time I arrived in Concord, and I parked my car along Main Street. The sidewalks were busy, a throng of families waiting outside a popular lunch place. Middle-aged women in sporty gear came in and out of the jewelry shops. I walked slowly toward Monument Square, crossing the wide intersection toward the entrance to the Old Hill Burying Ground. I squeezed through the stone markers and trudged up the steeply inclined path to the top of the hill. There was no one else in the cemetery. I went to the very peak of the hill, passing the bench where I'd sat with Ted Severson the last time I'd met with him, just over a month ago, and looked out over the roofs of Concord. Since I'd last been here, the trees on the hill had shed all their leaves, and I could see all the way to where I'd parked my car. I stood for a while, in my bright green jacket, enjoying the solitude and the bite of the cold New England air, and the godlike view of the scurrying pedestrians going about their errands on a Sunday that came with an extra hour. I looked at the spot where Ted and I had kissed, tried to remember what it had felt like. His surprisingly soft lips, his large, strong hand sliding up against my sweater. After 5 minutes, I turned my attention back along the spine of the hill with its sparse stone graves. Dead leaves had been blown by the wind and piled up against the backs of several stones. I walked slowly back down the flagstone path. Randomly picked a grave that was partially obscured by a twisted, leafless tree, and knelt in front of it. It marked a woman named Elizabeth Minot, who had died in 1790 at the age of 45. She, quote, met lingering death with calmness and joy. At the top of the stone was a winged skull, a banner around it that said, "Be mindful of death." I stayed crouched, studying the headstone, wondering what Elizabeth Minot's short, hard life had been like. Truth was, it didn't matter anymore. She was dead, and so was everyone who ever knew her. Maybe her husband had smothered her with a pillow to end her misery. Or to end his own. But he was long gone now as well. Their children were dead, and their children's children dead. My father used to say, every 100 years, all new people. I didn't know exactly why he said it, or what it meant to him. A variation on being mindful of death, I suppose, but I knew what it meant to me. I thought of the people I'd killed. Chet the painter, whose last name I still didn't know. Eric Washburn, dead before his life really got started. And poor Brad Daggett, who probably never stood a chance from the moment he first laid his eyes on Miranda Severson. I felt an ache in my chest. Not a familiar feeling, but one I recognized. It wasn't that I felt bad about what I had done, or guilty, I didn't. I had reasons, good ones, for everyone I'd killed. No, the ache in my chest was that I felt alone. That there were no other humans in the world who knew what I knew. I came down off the hill and walked back into town. I felt my cell phone vibrating in my purse. It was my mother. Darling, have you read the Times yet? I don't get the Times, I said. Oh, there's a whole piece about Martha Chang. You remember Martha, don't you, the choreographer? She described the feature in detail, reading parts out loud to me. I sat down on a cold bench with a view of Main Street. How's Dad? I asked when she was done. Woke up screaming in the middle of the night last night. I went in thinking he was just trying to get me into the bedroom, but he was a wreck, shivering and crying. I went to get him some hot milk and whiskey, and when I came back he was asleep again. Honestly, darling, it's like having a child in the house. I told her I had to go, and she told me a few more stories about friends of hers I didn't remember. When we hung up, I noticed that the crowds around the lunch place had thinned, and I went in, got a large coffee to go. Then I walked some more, back past the Concord River Inn, where I'd had drinks with Ted and plotted the murder of his wife. Our plan would have worked. It was very close to what had eventually happened. Framing Brad for the murder of Miranda, then making sure Brad disappeared forever, that his body was never found. The details were different. His body was going to be dumped in the ocean while I drove his truck into Boston, leaving it where it would get stolen and stripped. But the outcome would have been the same. I strolled along quiet back roads, lined with stately colonials. I was working my way toward the backside of the cemetery I'd just been in. A crew of gardeners was clearing leaves from one of the larger yards. A preteen boy was throwing a football straight up in the air, then catching it himself. I saw no one else. I got onto a dead-end street that abutted the backside of the cemetery. I hopped a short fence, leaned against a tree, and waited. I could see the top of the hill, the headstones spread along it like the knuckles of a spine. The sun, a glimmer of whiteness behind the pall of clouds, was low in the sky. I pulled my coffee close into my chest to keep me warm. My hair was up under the same dark hat I'd worn the night that Brad and Miranda had died. I wondered, not for the first time, what would have happened between Ted and me if things had gone according to plan. We would have become involved, I knew that, but how long would we have stayed together? Would I have told him everything? Shared my life with him? And would that knowledge, the knowledge both of us would have about each other, have made us stronger? Or would it have killed us in the end? Probably killed us, I thought. Although it might have been nice for a while. Nice to have someone with whom I could have shared it all. I finished my coffee, slid the empty cup into my open purse, and I waited.
Chapter 33, Kimball.
I had discovered that if I parked my car at the Dunkin' Donuts, the five-way intersection just off of Winslow Center, I could spot Lily Kintner driving down Layton Road away from her house. Very few cars came down Layton, and she was easy to spot in her dark red Honda. I'd waited here every day since our second interview, following Lily a total of 7 times. I'd followed her to and from her offices at Winslow College. I'd followed her to a grocery store and to a farmer's market 1 town over. Once she'd gotten onto the interstate heading south. I guessed she was probably going to Connecticut to see her parents, and I turned back. The few times she'd driven into Winslow Center to do errands, I'd followed her a little bit on foot, keeping a big distance. I'd seen nothing of interest. I was doing all of this on my own, using my own nondescript silver Sonata. I didn't know what I hoped to accomplish. I just knew in my heart that Lily Kintner was somehow involved, and if I kept watching, then maybe she might screw up somehow. I was parked at Dunkin' Donuts on Sunday afternoon, and just about to give up when I spotted Lily's Accord. She turned left on Brooks, heading east, away from the town center. I pulled out of the parking lot, slotting in about 3 cars behind her. Her Honda was an older model, boxier than the usual Hondas on the road now, and easier to follow. I trailed her through Stowe, then Maynard, then into West Concord. I tried to keep at least a couple cars between us at all times. I only lost her once, going through Maynard Center, where I got stuck behind a UPS truck, but I guessed correctly that she was staying on Route 62, and I caught up with her again. She drove into Concord Center, parked on Main Street, and got out of her car. She was wearing her bright green coat, buttoned up to her neck. I watched her walk toward what looked like a large rotary that looped around a smallish park. The only person who knew I was trailing Lily Kintner was Roberta James, my partner, although she didn't know how often I was doing it. She certainly didn't know that on 2 occasions I had parked after dark on Layton Road and worked my way through the woods to spy on Lily's house from the edge of her property. I'd watched her for an hour one night, as she sat in her red leather chair, her legs tucked up under her, reading a hardcover book. While she read, she absentmindedly twirled a long strand of hair in a finger. A cup of tea next to her sent up a ribbon of steam. I had kept telling myself to leave, but I felt glued to the spot, and if she had suddenly come outside and spotted me, I don't think I could have left even then. I would never tell James any of that. She was already suspicious of my motives. "What does she look like, Hen?" she asked me the night before. I had her over for spaghetti carbonara and scotch. "She's beautiful," I said, deciding not to lie. "Uh-huh," James said, not needing to add anything more. "Listen," I said. "Eric Washburn was her college boyfriend. He was also the boyfriend of Miranda Severson, or Faith Hobart, as she was known then. Miranda told me that Lily had stolen Eric from her, then Lily told me that Miranda had stolen him back. Eric died from a nut allergy the year he graduated from college. He was with Lily in London." "You think she killed him with nuts?" "If she did, then it was pretty brilliant. You can't really prove something like that wasn't an accident." "Okay." James nodded, took a sip of her Macallan. "Now, years later, she becomes friends with Miranda's husband, maybe more than friends, and then he gets killed." "He was killed by Brad Daggett, we know this. Do you think Lily also knew him?" "No, I don't. I just know that she lied to me, and that it's a pretty huge coincidence that she was somehow involved with both the death of this Eric Washburn and now with Miranda." "We can bring her in, question her some more. Did you ask her if she had an alibi for the night that Miranda got killed?" "No, I didn't ask her. I mean, we know Brad did that as well. Is it possible that she knew Brad all along, that she got him to do these 2 murders and now she knows where he is?" "Sure, it's possible. But why would she do it? People don't go around murdering the girl who stole their boyfriend in college." "Yeah, well," I said. "That's all you've got? Yeah, well?" "Yeah, that's all I've got." James smiled. She didn't do it often, but when she did, It changed her face from something a little severe to one that radiated beauty. We'd been partnered up in the department for just over a year. The scotch and pasta nights had started about 3 months ago. So far, our partnership had been the greatest non-sexual partnership in my life. From day one, we'd slipped into an easy back-and-forth conversational pattern that made me feel like we'd been friends for years. It was only recently that I realized how little I knew about Roberta James, besides where she'd grown up, coast of Maryland, where she'd gone to school, the University of Delaware, and where she lived, third floor of a triple-decker in Watertown. I assumed she was gay, but we'd never talked about it. When I'd finally broached the subject, at the first of our pasta nights, she'd said, "I like men, but only in theory." "Meaning in reality you like women?" "No. I mean I'm voluntarily celibate, but if I ever decided I didn't want to be celibate, I would be with a man." "Got it, James," I said, and didn't ask for any more clarification. Her usually unwavering stare had wavered a little during the brief exchange. Most of our scotch and pasta nights were at my place, probably since I always overdid the scotch, and when James hosted, she always made me sleep on her couch. On one of those nights, I'd gotten up from the couch to get a glass of water, and when I walked back down the hallway past James's bedroom, I noticed her door was cracked open, yellow light slanting through. I pushed the door open a little farther, saying, "Knock, knock." James was on the bed reading a paperback. It was a warm night, and she had kicked one of her long legs out from under the single sheet that covered her. She wore reading glasses and looked quizzically at me over the frames. "Can't sleep," I said. "I thought you might like some company." I'm not sure how I expected James to react to my proposition, but I hadn't expected the explosion of deep laughter that I was greeted with. I held up both my hands and backed out of the doorway, saying, "Okay, okay." She tried to stop me from going, but I quickly retreated to the couch. In the morning, James was up at dawn and brought me a cup of coffee. "Sorry for the laughter last night," she said as she handed it to me. "No," I said. "Sorry for the late-night bedroom visit. Totally inappropriate." My voice was gravelly, and my head felt like it was gripped in a vice. "I think you caught me totally by surprise. The last three times I've been hit on was by a woman. Anyway, I feel bad about it." "You shouldn't. I was the one who was trying to cross the line. Besides, we make good partners at work. Why fuck that up?" "Right. Why fuck that up?" That had been the extent of our conversation on the subject. We'd been a little awkward for a while at work, but it went away. And now we were back to regular get-togethers and discussions of my love life. "So, are you planning on following her again tomorrow?" James said, pouring us each a little more scotch. "I don't know," I said. "Maybe I should take a day off." "Maybe you should. I'm sure you're very good at it, but it's only a matter of time before she spots you and makes a complaint." "You're right," I said, knowing I wasn't going to listen to her. When Lily was toward the end of Main Street, down near the Rotary, I got out of my car and started to follow her on foot. I watched her cross the wide intersection, make her way toward a white, boxy church, its steeple wreathed in scaffolding, then turn right and enter a hillside cemetery. I sat on a low stone wall and began to roll a cigarette. She was about 200 yards away, but easy to see in her green jacket. I watched her slowly walk up the cemetery path. She wandered for a while, briefly disappearing behind the slate roof of an old stone house with a pergola. I lit my cigarette, and a middle-aged woman in a spandex biking outfit clattering by in her biking shoes shot a look in my direction as though I'd just murdered her children. I kept my eye on the cemetery. Eventually, I could see Lily again, walking along the top of the hill. She must have found the grave she was looking for, a stone marker under a twisted tree. She crouched and read its inscription, staying in that position for a while before standing and coming back down the hill. I wondered whose gravestone that was, and if it meant anything. When Lily reached the sidewalk in front of the cemetery and began to cross Monument Square in my direction, I retreated, crossing Main Street and going into an upscale woman's clothing store that was fronted with glass. I pretended to study a rack of scarves, all priced at about the cost of a decent used car, and kept my eye on Lily, who made her way to a stone bench, where she was now talking on her cell phone. I was close enough to see that one strand of her red hair had fallen out from under her dark hat.
"They're all cashmere," said the shopkeeper, who was suddenly about 2 inches behind me.
I jumped a little. "They're beautiful. So soft."
"Aren't they?"
I moved away from the scarves and looked around the little store some more. Lily looked like she would be at the bench for a while. After a few minutes, I thanked the woman who worked there and headed back out onto the sidewalk. Lily was gone. I was worried that maybe she'd cross the street toward me to shop and that I would accidentally bump into her. So I walked away from the shops, back toward the low wall I'd sat on earlier. What I really wanted to do was walk up the hillside cemetery myself and take a look at the gravestone that Lily had read with such interest. The grave was immediately under a gnarled tree that jutted out from the crest of the hill, and I was sure that I could find it. But it would be better to visit the cemetery when I knew that Lily wouldn't spot me there. I decided to wait. I took a long look around from my perch. Lily had disappeared, and I began to get nervous that she would suddenly appear and spot me. I decided that I didn't need to find her again. Instead, I stood and walked away from Concord Center. I passed an old gray-shingled hotel called the Concord River Inn. Smoke was issuing from its chimney, and it looked like the type of place that probably had a bar. I went in. There was a dining room in front, with white tablecloths and ornately papered walls, but I could hear voices coming from the rear of the inn. I walked down a low-ceilinged hallway and found a small bar, wedged into a space not a whole lot bigger than a parking space. I quickly scanned the room to make sure Lily wasn't there. There were two couples finishing up their late lunches, and one lone man reading the newspaper and drinking a bottle of Grolsch. I pulled myself onto an uncomfortable wooden stool at the short bar and ordered a Boddington's on draft. My plan was to slowly drink my beer, then go and check out the gravestone that Lily had been looking at. I didn't expect to learn anything from it. In that old cemetery, it was probably a marker for someone who had died over 200 years ago, but I felt a compulsion to look at it. Lily had stared so intently at its words, and I wanted to know why. I thought of my dinner with James the night before, and her unspoken warning that I was becoming obsessed with Lily Kintner in an unprofessional manner. Probably I was. I took a sip of my beer, ate a tiny pretzel stick from the bowl on the bar, and took out a pen from my jacket pocket. On one of the bar napkins, I scrawled a limerick. There was once a copper named Kimball, whose brain was as big as a thimble. He followed a girl all over the world, and hoped that at sex she'd be nimble. I crumpled the napkin up and shoved it in my jacket pocket. I peeled a new napkin away from the pile on the bar and tried again. There once was a girl with red hair, whose bottom I hoped to see bare. The chance this would happen was one in a million, but I'd settle for lace underwear. I crumpled that as well, shoved it into my pocket with the other napkin, then continued to drink my beer. I suddenly felt ridiculous, not so much for the terrible limericks, but for the fact that I had been obsessively following a woman tangentially involved in a case without my department's knowledge. James was right. If I thought Lily Kintner was hiding something, I should simply pull her in and question her. The chances were that her only involvement in this case was that Ted Severson had fallen in love with her shortly before getting himself murdered. She had lied to me because of a stressful situation with her father, a public figure who was involved in his own murder case. She had nothing to do with Brad Daggett, who had killed both Ted and Miranda on his own, and disappeared off the face of the earth. The latest theory was that after killing Ted, Brad had most likely blackmailed Miranda, somehow insisting that the handoff of the money take place at the unfinished house. It would explain why they had met there late at night, and it might explain why Brad was able to vanish so completely. A substantial amount of cash would make it that much easier. I finished my beer and paid for it. I would leave the inn, go back to my car, and return to Boston. Tomorrow I would talk with my superintendent. Ask him if he thought pulling Lily Kintner in for questioning was a good idea. If he agreed that it was worth a shot, I'd have James accompany me. If he thought I was barking up the wrong tree, then maybe I'd wait a week, give Lily a call, see if she wanted to get a drink sometime. I stepped back through the low door of the inn. The day had darkened considerably in the half hour or so that I'd been inside. I reminded myself that daylight savings time was over, and dusk would come earlier. As I was walking back toward my car, I took a long look at the hillside cemetery. It was empty. In the fading light, I could make out the tree and the gravestone. It wouldn't hurt to take a look. I crossed the large intersection, found the small entranceway to the cemetery. A newish stone and dark polished granite told me that this was called the Old Hill Burying Ground. I walked up the steep path toward the tree, its leafless branches blackly etched against the stone-colored sky. I found the marker that Lily had studied so intently, crouched as she had done, and read its inscription. Mrs. Elizabeth Mino, dead in 1790. I suddenly wondered what I had possibly hoped to find from coming up here. I ran a finger along the worn inscription. It was a beautiful gravestone, with a sole effigy carved at the top, along with a warning. Be mindful of death. I shivered a little and stood up, both of my knees making popping sounds. My head swam a little in the colorless light of dusk. A steady wind began to swirl the fallen leaves on top of the hill. It was time to return home. I heard the snap of a branch coming from the other side of the hill. I turned. Lily Kintner was a few steps away, her hands in the large pockets of her coat, coming purposefully toward me. Her presence felt unreal, as though she were an apparition, and I smiled, not knowing what else to do. Should I admit to following her? Should I pretend this was a total coincidence? She kept coming, till she was just inches away. I thought for a moment she was going to kiss me, but instead she said, in a low whisper, "I'm sorry." I felt a stinging pressure against my ribs, and when I looked down, I saw her gloved hand pushing the knife up and into me, up and toward my heart.
Chapter 34 Lily. From my spot under the horse chestnut tree on the outskirts of the cemetery, I spotted the solitary figure along the ridge. The light was fading fast, but I could see that it was Detective Kimball. I watched him crouch and take a look at the gravestone, the same one that I'd looked at earlier. Mrs. Mino. I took a moment, shaking my arms to get the blood moving, to congratulate myself on how easily I'd lured Kimball to an isolated spot, just as dusk was coming on. As I began to walk toward him, I looked around, on the off chance that there were other visitors to this cemetery, but we were alone. When I was less than 5 yards from Kimball, I stepped on a fallen branch, and he turned. In one pocket was my stun gun, and in the other was my filleting knife. I had planned on stunning Detective Kimball first, then stabbing him, but he seemed so surprised, so dazed to see me, that I simply stepped in close and slid the knife between his ribs, angling it so that the knife would reach his heart. It was all so easy. His face went white, and I felt his warm blood as it spilled onto my hand. With our eyes locked and my own heartbeat loud in my ears, I only barely registered the thudding footsteps climbing the hill to my left. "Step away from him and put your hands up," barked a female voice over the rustling wind. I turned and watched as a tall, black woman in a trench coat scaled the path, holding a gun in both hands. Her unbuttoned coat whipped out behind her, snapping in the wind. I let go of the knife, and Kimball fell to both knees, one of them cracking loudly on a flagstone. I raised both hands and took a step backward. I watched the woman's eyes scour Kimball as she kept moving forward. She registered the knife protruding from his ribs and began moving faster, reaching Kimball and swinging the gun one-handed in my direction. "Get the fuck on the ground right now! Face the fuck down!" I could practically hear the adrenaline coursing through her as she spoke, and I did as she said, stretching out along the cold, hard ground of the cemetery. I had no intention of fighting,
or running away. I had been caught. Just lie there and don't move, Hen. Leave the knife where it is, okay? The woman's voice, talking to Kemble, was low and purring. I turned my head so I could just make out the scene. The woman, rapidly punching numbers into her cell phone, the gun still pointed in my direction. She called 911, requesting an ambulance to some fucking cemetery in Concord Center. It's on a hill. She identified herself as Detective Roberta James of the Boston Police Department and told the dispatcher that there was an officer down. She ended the call, checked briefly on Detective Kemble. This doesn't look so bad, Hen. Just lie still. Then turned to face me. I heard a whiskering sound as she whipped her cloth belt out of the loops on her coat. She planted a knee in the center of my back and leaned all her weight on it. I felt the cold tip of her gun pressed against my neck. Don't give me a fucking reason, she said. Hands behind your back. I did as she said, and with one hand, she tightly and expertly knotted her cloth belt around the wrists of my hands. You move at all and I'll shoot you in the head, she said. I relaxed my body. The wind blew a crumpled leaf against my cheek. I closed my eyes and thought, with disbelief and horror, how my life was over. I could hear the female detective's low voice humming to Kemble. He said something back, but I couldn't make out the words. Now that I'd been caught, there was no reason for me to want him to die. In fact, I hoped he'd live, and thought he probably would. I hadn't pushed the knife all the way in. In the distance, I heard the approaching siren of an ambulance. I listened as the woman detective told Kemble that he was going to be all right, that he was going to live. I opened my eyes. A strand of my hair was obscuring my vision, but I could partially see the tableau before me. Detective Kemble laid out in front of Elizabeth Minot's grave, the woman over him, her hand pressed against his side to slow the bleeding. The sky darkened to the color of slate, and the faint, flashing lights of the ambulance were just beginning to illuminate the scene. 24 hours later, my bail was denied at the Middlesex County Courthouse. We'll try again, my state-appointed lawyer said. Her name was Stephanie Flynn, and she was about 25 years old. She was small-featured and pretty, but her fingernails were bitten down to the quick, and she looked like she hadn't had a good night's sleep in years. She came back with me to my holding cell. They'll grant a bail review, and they won't be able to hold you. Not with these circumstances. It's okay, I said. You did your best. I do realize I stabbed a police officer. A police officer who was harassing and following you, Stephanie said, staring intently at me through her stylish glasses. He's in the clear now, by the way, she continued. Just got moved out of ICU. That's good, I said. My lawyer checked her watch, promised me she'd be back at the same time tomorrow. I could have paid for my own lawyer or had my parents send one, but I chose to have one appointed for me, and right now, I felt good about that decision. After she left, I laid back on my cot in my dark green jumpsuit. My lunch, a hamburger with a side of mixed vegetables, was delivered by a grim-faced policewoman in uniform. I wasn't particularly hungry, but ate a little of the burger, and drank the plastic cup of apple juice that had come with the meal. I refilled the cup with tepid water from the tap in my cell and drank several glasses, then lay back down on my cot. My parents, whom I'd finally called this morning collect from a wall-installed payphone down the hall, were coming soon, and I was savoring a little bit of quiet before they arrived. The previous day, as I remained still and quiet at the Old Hill Burying Ground, while first one ambulance, then several,
Then a flotilla of cop cars arrived. I thought about what I'd say when I was questioned later. I considered telling the truth, the whole truth, about the two